Okay, so tonight we're here to reflect on the incarnation with the help of poets. And my hopes for this evening are twofold. If you're not a regular poetry reader, I hope to kindle in you a desire to seek out and read good poets on a regular basis. And to enable you to do this, I want to give you tools for your readerly tool belt that will be of particular aid in the work of reading poems well, but will indeed make you a better reader in general. And also because our attention will be given to poems that are dealing with what I have been calling the what and the so what of the incarnation, I hope that you will be, to use language from the poems that we will be looking at, stopped short in your assumptions, dumbfounded, spirited from sleep by the truly radical, and I mean that as in going to the very root of things, the truly radical nature of God in flesh. And this is the Latin meaning of the word incarnation, in flesh. So perhaps this central mystery of Christianity is one that you only give half a thought to at Christmas time, when we rightly wonder, what child is this? And we proclaim exuberantly, joy to the world, the Lord is come. And if this is the case, or if you're here not so much for the theology, but for the poetry, I hope to inspire in us all a keen awareness of the everydayness of the incarnation and our need to grasp, however feebly, the significance of God in flesh for everything to do with human existence and salvation. So that's what we're aiming at for this evening. The route that we're going to take to get there is this. I will begin with a brief discussion of what's at stake for us in affirming that Jesus, a Jew from Nazareth who lived and taught and healed people and ate with them and died and purportedly rose from the dead over 2,000 years ago, was both fully God and fully human. Then we will read three poems together, each focusing, or maybe a better image is refracting, the what and the so what of the incarnation. Before each poem, I will offer some teaching on specific elements of poetry that will be useful for you and for all of us in reading each poem. Then we will read each poem twice, because once is hardly enough to catch your breath. And I will ask for a volunteer for the second reading. So I don't have anybody staged to do that. So if you're inclined to reading aloud, please don't hesitate to volunteer when I ask for volunteers. And then after each poem, I will ask you to initially share three things. Words that you like, images that are crisp, and feelings or ideas that stir you. And sharing these things with one another is the gift of corporate reading, and it will help us all to notice and pay attention to each poem more thoroughly. And then we'll discuss it more, and we'll go from there. And I may offer a bit of commentary on pertinent biblical passages and do a bit of theologizing with each poem, but my real intent tonight is to let these poems speak. And if I can shape the silence that these poems are heard into and to make way for us to really hear them, then I think our evening will have been a success. Usually we save discussion for the end here, but I want to discuss each poem in turn. So while we can extend the discussion after the lecture, I want this to be more of an interactive process together. So I'm going to pray, and then we will continue. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God in flesh. Would you come and dwell here with us tonight? Open our eyes to see you. Open our ears to hear you. Open our hearts to receive you. Amen. So, to set the stage a bit more adequately for these poems, I want to take a moment to outline what's at stake for us in the doctrine of the Incarnation. In Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis wrote, "Christianity is a religion you could not have guessed." And by this, he is pointing to the profound surprises that defy human logic that unfold in the biblical story. He is pointing to the central surprise, the mystery of God in flesh. And this kind of mystery is not the whodunit type, the kind of mystery that we can solve by cleverly tracking clues and reading between the lines. Indeed, unlike this kind of mystery, God is not trying to hide something from us, but rather reveal someone, himself, to us. This kind of mystery, this holy self-revelation, is the definitive paradox. Two extremes, starkly and strikingly together, distinct but inextricable from one another. God and human, creator and created. The mystery of the Incarnation, in other words, takes us beyond our rational and intuitive abilities to figure things out. It takes us beyond what we could have guessed into paradox, and is at the same time what makes paradox possible. The early heresies that prompted the church to articulate orthodoxy center not on what Christ did, but on who he was. They centered on the nature of Christ's being. In a little book called Heresies and How to Avoid Them, which I recommend, contributor A.N. Williams wrote, "Heresies tend precisely not to be mischievous. If anything, they tried to represent views that are too conservative, too wary of believing that what the Father, the Son, and the Spirit have done and are still doing in this world surpass all our wildest imaginings." She goes on, "Christian orthodoxy is always dangerous. The immensity of its declarations and implications, asking us radically to revise the way we think about the world and act in it as the consequence of our beliefs." So if I can put it this way, if you want a religion that you could guess, you want to be conservative in all the wrong ways. If you want a religion you can imagine, you want to play life safe, perhaps ironically, to your great harm. What's at stake for us in the doctrine of the Incarnation is how we think about the world and act in it. What's at stake is a bridge that fully spans at both ends the chasm between God and humans, torn through all of creation at the fall. What's at stake is God's character and the nature of revelation. It offers us firsthand, not secondhand, knowledge of who God is. What's at stake is the salvation of the whole person, not merely our souls or our minds. What's at stake is the plausibility of paradox, the plausibility of what poet John Keats called negative capability. He calls this the capacity for being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And here at LaBrie, we may warn against too quickly labeling something difficult to understand a mystery. while at the same time recognizing that, like all the great heresies of the 4th and 5th centuries over who Jesus Christ was, to deny paradox and mystery a hard-earned place at the table is, and I'm quoting the writer from the Heresies book, is to carve the reality of God down to fit within our own small world of thought, rather than to allow his revelation to stand and reform our own thinking. So I hope you can see that I think there's a lot at stake here. In a nutshell, the two earliest misunderstandings of the nature of the Incarnation are known as Arianism and Docetism. The first does not accept Christ's full divinity, and the second does not accept Christ's full humanity. These errors, too far in one direction or the other, are not mere relics of church history. These things that we could not have guessed, that a man could be God, and this kind of epitomizes the Jewish conundrum, and that God could be a man, this was the Greek conundrum, are, I think, as offensive or at least mind-bending to us today as they were in the first centuries after Christ's death and resurrection. So, which conundrum is your conundrum tonight? That the eternal, universal creator God could be fully a particular human at a particular time in a particular place? Or that a particular human could be fully the universal God eternal? And what has poetry to do with all of this? Attention to the particulars of the whole of life are the stock and trade of poetry. So hear those two words, attention and particulars. The poet's first response to the world is attention. Stillness, wonder, reflection, the posture of being addressed by life, by the particulars of life. The small, the incidental, speaking with a large and resonant voice. The vast, seemingly unreachable, brought suddenly close and into focus, right under our noses. A French philosopher named Gaston Bachelard noted, "If a poet looks through a microscope or a telescope, he always sees the same thing." We could probably puzzle on that for a while. But whether it is the small made large or the distant brought close, viewing the large and the small is the currency of poetry. For it is the grasp of significant detail that brings a poem alive. You might say the poet is driven to really see what is really there. And what is really there is always, again in Lewis's words, what you could not have guessed. Until we're ready to be surprised, we are not ready to receive anything from life, or from one another, or from God himself. So I would contend that poetry can school us in attention and surprise over what is really there to really see. More often than not, this kind of attention lands us in the territory of paradox. In this way, poetry at its best may be a safeguard against heresy. It may be an antidote to cynicism. It may be a force to pull back the wool stretched over our eyes. So on that lofty note, let's turn to the poems themselves. I had chosen three contemporary poems, two by Americans and one by a Canadian. Two of the poets are still living, and I chose contemporary poems partly because these are poems that I have been reading for some time, and feel that I know in some way, and I keep getting to know. And because contemporary poetry is written in a familiar idiom or way of speaking, and that makes them a little more approachable than poems from centuries past. The first poem that we'll read together is by Andrew Hudgens. Hudgens was born in Texas to a military family, and he lived throughout the American South during his childhood. He earned his MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop and has only just retired from teaching at Ohio State University to move to Sewanee, Tennessee to teach at the Writers' Workshop there. He is associated with the Southern Gothic tradition of literature, so think Flannery O'Connor and the grotesque here. And his poems are often narratives, stories, though this one is not. I corresponded with him over email about the poem that we will read. He was lovely. I initiated email conversation with him because there's a version of this poem floating around the internet that is not the version that I had in a published collection of his. So I wanted to know which one's the finished one, which one is the definitive version. And I was very happy to learn that the one floating around on the internet is not the one. So you need to know that, because if you Google it at home, what you will get online is not what you should read. But comparing them yielded some interesting fruit. In any case, this poem was published in his 2003 volume of verse called Ecstatic in the Poison. And I had said that his poems are often narratives telling a story, but this one is a lyric poem. And lyric poems are generally shorter poems, and the speaker of the poem is expressing emotion or recording a meditation. All three of the poems that we're reading tonight lean more in the lyric direction. So, three poetic elements that I want to alert you to before we read. Repetition. The meaning is obvious, I think. A word or a phrase that's used, or an image as well, that is used more than once. Poems have been described as language under pressure. And this means the only words there are words that have to be there. Nothing is wasted. Nothing is inconsequential. So repetition is of particular significance in poetry. If a word has been used once, why use it again? The second thing to know about is allusion. Allusion is a reference to something outside of the poem. If an allusion is obscure, or it goes undetected by the reader or hearer of the poem, it can be wasted. But recognized and understood, and the allusion can call up important associations and add layers of meaning to the poem. This is another benefit of corporate reading, because our collective knowledge and awareness of possible allusions will be very helpful. Sometimes poets put words or phrases in italics to tip the reader off that there is an allusion at play. Sometimes the poet gives the poem an epigraph, which is a little note under the title that's not part of the poem itself but may serve as a key. Sometimes the allusion is totally unmarked. So this is one of the ways that reading poems can feel a bit like a whodunit mystery. And I would simply say that when there are lines or phrases or titles that strike you as significant but opaque, a little research may be required. And finally, a note on the language of poetry. I recently came across the note that the language of poetry should be incandescent language, meaning it should bring both light and heat, because we need more heat tonight. I think the language of this poem does that. And I'll leave it up to you to agree or disagree with me and to say if and how you find this language to be incandescent. Finally, I mentioned at the beginning that I've been thinking of these poems as having something to offer us in regard to the what and the so what of the incarnation. Explicitly, this poem is in the territory of the what. And it is perhaps the most abrasive of the three poems. So in some ways, if you make it through this poem, things will get a little easier. Or if not easier, the type of difficulty will be different. So I'll read the poem once, and then I'll ask for a volunteer to read it for us a second time. As we hear the poem, take note of the words that you like. Just like the word itself. Take note of images that are crisp and ideas or feelings that stir you or what feelings are evoked in you. These observations will be the starting point for our discussion. I hope you can... I did a little test viewing, so you may be squinting in the back. But the poem is called Piss Christ, and there is an epigraph. Andres Serrano, 1987. If we did not know it was cow's blood and urine, if we did not know Serrano had for weeks hoarded his urine in a plastic vat, if we did not know the cross was gimcrack plastic, we would assume it was too beautiful. We would assume it was the resurrection, glory, Christ transformed to light by light, because the blood and urine burn like a halo, and light, as always, light makes it beautiful. We are born between the urine and the feces, Augustine says, and so was Christ, if there was a Christ, skidding into this world as we do, on a tide of blood and urine, blood, feces, urine. The fallen world is made of what we make. He peed, ejaculated, shat, wept, bled under Pontius Pilate, and I assume the mutilated God, the criminal, humiliated God, voided himself on the cross, and blood and urine smeared his legs. The piss Christ thrown in glowing blood, the whole and irreducible point of his descent, God plunged in human waste and radiant. There's someone who will read it for us a second time.
Thank you, Mayor.
If you're willing to stand up so your voice carries, that's great. Or you can just project.
That's going to be a little more nerve-wracking,
I'm not
sure.
Thank you.
Hi.
No. I'm going to scoot over just a tiny bit.
Okay. If we did not know it was once... Wait, if we did not know it was cow's blood and urine, if we did not know Serrano had for weeks hoarded his urine in a plastic vat, if we did not know the cross was gimcrack plastic, we would assume it was too beautiful. We would assume it was the resurrection, glory, Christ transformed to light by light, because the blood and urine burn like a halo. And light, as always, light makes it beautiful. We are born between the urine and the feces, Augustine says, and so is Christ. If there was a Christ, skidding into this world as we do, on a tide of blood and urine. Blood, feces, urine. The fallen world is made of what we make. He peed, ejaculated, shat, wept, bled under Pontius Pilate, and I assume the mutilated God, the criminal, humiliated God, voided himself on the cross, and blood and urine smeared his legs. The piss Christ, thrown in glowing blood, the whole and irreducible point of his descent, God plunged in human waste and radiant.
What words do you like or dislike?
Gimcrack.
I had to look it up and check the pronunciation. It's a new word for me. What else?
Skidding.
Mm-hmm.
Plunged.
Voided, but the usage here.
Voided.
Mutilated.
Radiant.
Smeared.
Skidding.
Irreducible.
And what images are crisp?
The fallen world is made of what we make. It's a pretty vivid image.
Plunged in human waste and radiance.
Glowing blood.
And say, if you have birthed a child or witnessed the birth of a child, skidding is a pretty good word.
Yeah. At the end.
Right at the end.
Born between the urine and the feces.
And maybe these things start to blur together. But what ideas or feelings stir you? What feelings are evoked in you?
Revulsion.
Confusion.
Scandal.
Gratitude.
Weight.
Like heaviness.
Yeah.
Thankfulness.
He wrote this.
Wonder.
Courage.
I'd like to hear more about that in a little bit. Yeah, Marty.
What it is to be human.
Yeah.
Life.
Mm-hmm.
Life.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk more about the language, and especially the repetition in this poem. Blood or bled appears 8 times. That's a lot. I mean, those are intense words to use at all in a poem, but to use them 8 times. And urine or peed also 8 times. And then light 4 times. And then those refrains, if we did not know, if we did not know, if we did not know, we would assume, we would assume, we would assume. So what do you think Hudgens is doing through this kind of almost rabid repetition of these words?
It's not about this.
You know, I was going to say, he could have called this poem Against Dr. Jones. Yeah.
What is the illusion?
Picture that was controversial by the National Artists Association. There's a call that caused a lot of very conservative people to doubt whether we should promote the arts at all anymore. Mm-hmm. Yes, we can talk about illusion. Yes, so this photograph by Andre Sereno was made and displayed in 1987 to just outrage and uproar. Like the reception of this caused great controversy, continues to cause great controversy. The photograph was vandalized in 2011, and after the Charlie Hebdo attack, a whole new flurry of controversy arose around this photograph as well. So Hudgens' poem comes in between the making of this photograph and then the vandalism of it. And I kind of wonder if the poem can help us read the vandalism as well as the photograph. Which might be a question to kick around a little bit. This is, it gives you an idea of the scale of the photo and then the destruction of it. Back to the language of the poem, we can kind of dwell on that a little bit longer. The contrast of the vulgar language and the sacred language, I think, is significant here. The religious language that he uses, resurrection, glory, transformed, halo, these are words that in another context or without the profane language could feel very fluffy and airy or jargony. But I think there's something about the juxtaposition of the vulgar language and the religious language that reinterprets or invigorates both in a different way. And remember what's at stake, holding contrast together, holding extremes together. And I think Hudgens is doing this on a language level as he's exploring the meaning of the incarnation here too. Back to illusion. So there's clearly the illusion, the main illusion that he gives the epigraph to is of this photograph. I wonder your impression, or if you knew of this photograph before tonight. It is quite literally a white plastic, and gimcrack means cheaply made. So a white gimcrack plastic crucifix submerged in a vat of urine. Sereno is known for his use of bodily fluids and excretions in his art. So this is nothing unique in terms of his corpus of work. That's kind of his thing. But the charge against him was that he did not show proper respect for Christ, that he committed sacrilege, that this is a desecration, that it's a sin against God or against Christianity. In whatever case, he just went way too far with this photograph. he had said that he was actually critiquing the commodification of religion. But I wonder what you make of Hudgens' take on this photograph. I'll go back to the poem. He could have called the poem Against Docetism. I sort of wonder if he could have also called it In Defense of Serrano.
I'm struck by this. Later in the poem, of course, like mutilated, humiliated, avoided, plunged, contrasted against the resurrection, beautiful, beauty burned like a halo of light. And I just think of the scripture that says, you know, my power is made perfect in weakness, and that the essentially the glory, the religious language, and the reason that Jesus matters is because of the humiliation, the mutilation, the blood, the void. They're so intertwined in the gospel.
Yeah. Lynn?
Mm-hmm. Really, any image of Christ you can say is not an icon in church, it's not a saint and a glass urn, anything like that. I think it's interesting that he uses the proof quantity. I mean, you know, it's cow's blood, it's urine, it's, you know, plastic bath, it's cheap plastic. I mean, just the emphasis is on the, just as Christ, the emphasis is on the cross, the function, the hearing emphasis is on not beautiful to move out of your
Yeah. It's literally waste, human waste. Ben.
I was just struck by the way, if we did not know, what he's really, in a sense, getting at maybe is if you just saw the image itself and let it speak for itself without knowing any background information about what the artist used, you wouldn't conclude anything. You would be struck by the beauty of it rather than the offense. Because the image itself is quite stunning. The only thing that makes offensive is knowing what we use.
Yeah.
So it's almost this interesting idea of just taking the image just as itself, or taking the image with a whole lot of backstory. Obviously, it's called this crisis, it's time in fact, but the image itself as an image, speaking as what it is, rather than some essay or some other.
And I will say in the earlier version of the poem that you can easily find later tonight if you want, he ends the earlier version. Did I even keep it here? I don't think I did. The essence of the lines are we have grown used to beauty without ugliness. We have grown used to useless beauty. And so Hudgens is very much trying to say, like, we have to have these two things together, the ugly and the beautiful. We're losing something about the beauty to not keep the relationship to the ugly there.
The things that I react to.
Revulsion
is that it's reflective of who we are. Like, we are that human thing.
Yeah.
It's only you know, it's beautiful to think about Christ as a beautiful thing, but to doubt the inclination to us as a human thing.
Yeah.
In a way, that's what it's still doing.
Yeah.
That's why I react to it that way. I'm like, wow, that is really stunning, but that's like my personal thing.
Yeah, he holds up a mirror. Yeah,
I remember a Christian critique of the Christian critique when it first came out. The Christian critique being of horror and how could he do this? And
yeah.
Some Christian came on and said, which I really enjoyed, he said, you know, you stop and think about it, and what it says is that we need to back up and say, this is a person who subjected himself out of love to something so much worse than getting peed on. Mm-hmm. It was, what a trivial thing you can do to Jesus to pee on him, yeah, compared to what he actually did allow himself to do for us. So it, for him, it was just a sort of a way to touch off your whole imagination and seeing what trivial ways we could, even if we hate him, how trivial that is compared to how trivial what we can do to him is compared to what he was allowed to do and have done to himself.
I have other poems that were written. You have a 76.
I immediately loved the poem, and I think what it is for me is I feel like if I consider myself above the shames of Christ, and I feel like these are bad things, then I don't know what Christ's priorities were. Clearly, if these even factor into, you know, my thought process, then like everything is the glory of God is the shame of the earth, and you know, God sees the beauty, and we see the desecration. I love how you said, you know, how beauty and ugliness are linked, and I feel like beauty is ugliness from another perspective.
You said courage earlier. Do you want to follow up on that, or
different thought? My perspective on it was courage in several ways. So, one, Christ's courage to actually go through all of that and put himself through all of that, knowing the intensity of how bad it was, how bad it was going to be, even to the point where at this very last day, he even said, you know, if it be your will, take this cup away from me. You know, and it getting that bad and having the courage to go through that, and also the courage of this writer to evoke such intense emotion, and combining such, like you said, vulgar language into this description, which actually is an interesting perspective on it, because what he does is he uses people's own thinking and their own illusion to actually cause like a tension in a way. Where, you know, if you didn't know that this was human waste, you would think something totally different. But now that he told you all of this, now it's all in your head. And it's hard to separate the truth from the reality. And the reality from the fiction.
I'm going to keep going so we can get to these other couple of poems as well. I do want to just mention, I think there are allusions to the Apostles' Creed here as well. He was born, he suffered under Pontius Pilate, he was crucified. Resurrection comes in the beginning instead of following that. I wonder if radiant is pointing towards the resurrection, but this clearly meant to let us dwell in Good Friday, as it were. I also think there's an allusion to Philippians 2. Although he existed in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, voided himself, a play of language there that Hudgens is making, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. He humbled himself. I think the repetition here of humiliated, mutilated, there's resonance there with what it means that Christ humbled himself. want to kind of keep that thought of courage as we come into this next poem by this lovely woman, Margaret Abbotton. I know she's so cute. What an endearing picture. Margaret Abbotton is a Canadian poet. She was born in 1918 in Ontario, and she spent much of her life in Toronto working various jobs, but not staying in any one job long enough if it threatened to become a career. She moved along and kept writing very much as a priority. But she often had social work jobs, and she was very concerned to live alongside those who suffered. She was a poet before she was a Christian, and her second collection, called The Dumbfounding, published in 1966, both established her as one of the most accomplished poets in Canada and identified her poetry as markedly Christian. In her first collection, there's a sonnet called Snow, and it begins, "Nobody stuffs the world in at your eyes. The optic heart must venture a jailbreak and recreation." So from the start, Abbotton understood her work as a poet as one of attending to the particulars of the world, seeing with the eye and with the eye of the heart, fearlessly, even rebelliously, if that is how we are to understand the need for a jailbreak and recreation. The optic heart that she applied so diligently to the world around her, she applied to the Bible. And describing her own conversion to Christianity, she recalls reading the Gospel of John every morning, and the particular morning that she read John 14:1. This is what she says. 7 o'clock in the morning, and there I was. You believe in God, believe also in me. In you, I said. I had such a strong sense of the presence of Jesus in the room that I said it aloud. Well, okay, I'll believe in you, but don't touch the poetry, because it's all I've got left. It was as if I was enclosed in marble. Everything just absolutely froze. So I picked up my Bible and threw it across the room and said, okay, take everything then. I just like her. there are two poems in this collection, The Dumbfounding, that seem to be explicitly about her conversion. The first is called The Word. They come back to back, if I recall. And it's a tangle of hyphenated speech, and it seems poised at the edge of decision about what to make of Christ's death on the cross, and what his death on the cross means about who he is. And the second, which we will read, is the title poem of the book. It's also called The Dumbfounding, which she describes as an attempt to state in simple, real terms how the mystery of the gospel now newly envelops me. It's my personal opinion that her conversion occurs between these two poems, if not literally, metaphorically. So three elements of poetry I want to flag for you. Point of view and persona. So a poem, like a story, is conveyed through the eye and the mind of someone or something, not necessarily the poet or the author. The persona is the person or the thing that is speaking in the poem. And it's the persona's voice that we hear, and it's from the persona's point of view that we encounter the subject or the problem or the experience that's explored in the poem. So it can be first person singular, an explicit or implicit I or we. That would be first person plural, the we. It can be second person, this is less common, you. The reader is being you're, it's like you're being told that this is you. And it can be third person, he, she, they, it. The second is tone, and the tone of a poem is the complex of attitudes towards the poem's subject. And this includes both the persona and the poet, if you can distinguish them. And you can sometimes. And then form. This would involve the shape of the poem, including the line breaks and the stanza breaks. What are we to make of the way a poem looks? And I'll just say that the visual nature of poetry is a relatively new thing in the history of poetry. First and always first is the oral and aural nature of poetry. Poetry is memorable speech. So think of the shape of the sound, the rhythm and rhyme, the consonants, the sound of consonants, and the assonants, which are the vowel sounds. And think also about the visual shape of the poem on the page. So I'll say more about form after we read the poem. But just keep in mind the question, what does the shape of the poem do? To reading. I know this one's a little harder for you than that, so. Sorry. The dumbfounding. When you walked here, took skin, muscle, hair, eyes, larynx, we withheld all honor. His house is clay. How can he tell us of his far country? Your not familiar pace in flesh across the waves woke only our distrust. Twice torn, we cried, a ghost, and only on our planks counted you fast. Dust wet with your spittle cleared mortal trouble. We called you a blasphemer, a devil tamer. The evening you spoke of going away, we could not stay. All legions massed, you had to wash and rise alone and face out of the light for us. You died. We said, the worst is true. Our bliss has come to this. When you were seen by men in holy flesh again, we hoped so despairingly for such reports, we closed their windpipes for it. Now you have sought and seek in all our ways, all thoughts, streets, musics, and we make of these a din, trying to lock you out or in, to be intent and dying. Yet you are constant and sure, the all-lovely, all-men's way to that far country. Lead through the garden to trash, rubble, hill, where the outcast's outcast, you sound dark's uttermost, strangely light-brimming, until time be full. I forgot to remind you to listen for words that you like and images that are crisp and feelings that stir you. So think about that in the second reading. Is there a volunteer to read it one more time? Thank you, Hannah. You can read it from here if you want to. I have my notes.
When you walked here, took skin, muscles, hair, eyes, larynx, we withheld all honor. His house is clay. How can he tell us of his far country? your not familiar face in flesh cross the wave, woke only our distress. Twice torn, we cry, a ghost, and only on our plank counted you fast. Dust wet with your spittle, cleared mortal trouble, we called you a blasphemer, a devil tamer. The evening you spoke of going away, we could not stay. All legions masked, you had to wash and rise alone, and face out of the light for us. You died, we said, the worst is true, our bliss has come to this. When you were seen by men in holy flesh again, we hoped so despairingly for such report, we closed their windpipes for it. Now you have sought and seek in all our ways, all thoughts, streets, music, and we make of these a din, trying to lock you out or in, to be intent and dying. Yet you are constant and sure, the all-lovely, all-men's way to that far country. Lead through the garden to trash, rubble, hill, where the outcast, you sound dark uttermost, strangely light for me, and to time be full.
Words that you like.
Outcast.
Lovely.
Lovely.
Holy flesh.
Holy flesh.
Legions.
Little. Rubble. I like rubble.
Plank.
Twice torn.
Yes.
Yes.
Out or in.
Brimming. And images that are crisp, striking.
Close their windpipes for it.
Trying to lock you out for it. Counted you fast on our plank.
Facing out of the light.
A devil tamer.
And emotions or thoughts that stir you, or feelings that are evoked in you?
Second to last paragraph is beautiful. All men's way.
Okay. What else do you notice in the poem, particularly around the speaker or the persona here? Ben?
Seems like at times it's the voice of his disciples, at times it's the voice of other people that came to Jesus.
Yeah. It's this shifting in the poem. So I'll just kind of go through the stanzas here. We have the citizens of Nazareth, we have the disciples in the boat, we have the Pharisees, we have the disciples again. This 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stanza, when you were seen by men in holy flesh again, we hope so despairingly for such report, we closed their windpipes for it. who is that?
Yeah.
I wonder, is that those who would martyr the disciples? Is that some description of wanting something more than you will let yourself acknowledge? You want it, like fighting a desire that you're not willing to have. Find that an enigmatic stanza to the poem.
Maybe also the idea of the Pharisees, they bribed the guards not to speak about it.
Hmm.
They kind of closed the guards not talking about Christ's resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, like they were wanting it.
Like yeah.
They knew they should want it, but they didn't want it.
Mm-hmm. 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 So I just want to note at the beginning again this separation of clay and far country, this separation of heaven and earth, the unfathomable quality of these things being brought together. These reactions, all these different responses to who Jesus is throughout the poem. And I think there's a significance to it being a shifting we, and this sense at the end of surrender to who Christ is, lead. So now it's an address to Christ, lead through the garden. And so I wonder if Avison herself is kind of owning the response of all of the responses to Christ in the Gospels, experiencing them in some way herself.
I like how it takes us through shifting through the variety of perspectives, and has us see the same image but from a different angle. And it sort of helps clarify the image of where everyone was coming from when Christ came. And the spiritual travel that
Marty.
I always thought that one of the most difficult things Christ took on is people believe that he was understood. And his whole poem strikes me as the only commentary on the beginning of John when he came with all of his own will and mind.
Yeah.
That it's the willingness to the Creator come into the world, willingness to come into the world and be made.
I think that's a great observation. But yeah, the misunderstanding, the profound misunderstanding. Yeah, again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. I think it also invites us into the struggle of those who misunderstood, and especially from the beginning of the poem, I felt like I could identify with a very traditional Jew. Who is really wrestling with that Jewish conundrum of, like, how can God be this man? How do I address this? How can I handle this within my neat box of tradition and religion? And then I think the way she shifts it later sort of pulls us into that struggle and helps us to say, like, what are our traditional boxes? And how do we view Christ in these neat packages of religion and that... We can't just look back at the Bible and be like, oh, I would totally recognize him if I was there. And, like, if we don't recognize him when he's here. So I think that's part of how she pulls us into that struggle.
And in that final stanza, lead through the garden to trash. That's not... So the first thing that comes to my mind. Yes. I will follow you to the rubble. But it does. It challenges our categories and our assumptions for what it will mean to follow. Ben has a line actually in a song that goes, there's a hook in this meal. To receive is to follow. You won't always say where. And I think like that, I think of that often. I was thinking of that in this poem too. Oh, where's this going to take me? Sorry.
I'm just struck by the present tense. A lot of it is past tense. I can't quite see the very last two lines of the first page. Now you have sought and seek.
Yeah.
And then in the very last stanza, it says, where the outcast, use down the dark starless. Somehow, that image of Christ, not just having been through the darkness at tent, and now it's available, but somehow he is still sounding the dark, the uttermost darkness now for us in places of despair and broken dress. That's a powerful image. And the three of the present tense in those two places.
Thank you for drawing the attention.
And there's also like still waiting, like still until time will be told. So it's still like that waiting for that fulfillment of the light bringing into the darkness. Almost there. Like you can taste it, but then you're like, no. I still have to go through more trash.
The dying piece. We have a repetition here again. Died and then dying, and so it's just such a bold statement. You died. And then I think in the dying case, I think it's a statement about us here. You have sought and seek in all our ways, all thoughts, streets, music, and we make it leave the din, trying to lock you out or in to be intent and dying. And I wonder if it's a statement of like, well, we still have to reckon with that problem, that death thing that is there for all of us. I wanted to just say about form, because Ben, you pointed to the shift in time here. That's one thing to think about when you think of the form of a poem. Look for shifts. Look for reversals. Look for those moments in the poem where something is shifting. So, and that's often the form reflects that as well. I'm happy to talk more about free verse and formal things, but I want to save that maybe for the very end if you want to come back to that. Margaret Avison is a contemporary of an American poet named Denise Levertov, and Levertov has written quite a bit about what she calls organic verse, and she's very concerned to distinguish it from free verse. And so there are some interesting thoughts around that, if you're curious, that we can come back to. What I will say now is she says that free verse isolates the rightness of each line or cadence. If it seems expressive, okay, never mind the relation of it to what comes next. While in organic verse, the peculiar rhythms of the parts are in some degree modified, if necessary, in order to discover the rhythm of the whole. So she sees, and I think Avison's style as well resonates with that description of form. So let's, unless anyone has something burning on this poem that they want to say, we'll go to the third poem now. The final poem that we will read tonight is by Richard Wilbur, who was born in New York City in 1921, but lived most of his life here in Massachusetts. And Richard Wilbur has had great success as a poet. He's been the poet laureate of the U.S. He's won just about every significant prize in poetry that there is to win, including the Pulitzer Prize twice. the first time for his second collection, called Things of This World, published in 1957, and our poem comes from that collection tonight. Wilbur is a formalist. He prefers traditional forms, meters, rhyme patterns, and he generally keeps the I out of his poems. And this put him at odds with the confessional school and the free verse of his contemporaries in the 60s and 70s. While it has been noted that his poems have become more personal as he's aged, one reviewer has noted that Wilbur's poems matter not because they may or may not be stylish at any given moment, but because they keep the English language alive. Wilbur's great poems feel as fresh, as astonishing, as perplexing, as shocking as they did 50 years ago. So we are going to read Love Calls Us to the Things of This World. And it's one of his most anthologized poems. Unlike the first two poems, there is no explicit reference to Jesus Christ or the Bible or the Christian faith. However, some critics have seen a reference to St. Augustine's Confessions in the title of the poem. And they point to this passage from Book 10. I have learnt to love you late, beauty at once so ancient and new. I have learnt to love you late. You were with me, and I was in the world outside myself. I searched for you outside myself, and disfigured as I was, I fell upon the lovely things of your creation. You were with me, but I was not with you. The beautiful things of this world kept me far from you, and yet, if they had not been in you, they would have no being at all. Wilbur himself has noted, Plato, St. Teresa, and the rest of us in our degree have known that it is painful to return to the cave, to the earth, to the quotidian. Augustine says it is love that brings us back. This is a poem, then, precisely about the so what of the incarnation. It is a poem about the relationship of extremes, of body and spirit, of high and low, of sacred and profane. So three poetic elements. Imagery, what we are meant to see with the mind's eye. The pictures that are painted with words. The picture painted should have the effect of enabling the reader or hearer to see the thing depicted newly, freshly, clearly, with surprise, delight, maybe horror even. But there shouldn't be a lot of fuzziness around what is being seen. Diction is the fancy word for word choice. So this is about the thesaurus. Why does a poet use astounded instead of shocked? Why rosy instead of red? In addition to their aural, the sound qualities, because sometimes a poet may simply choose a word for that reason. But words have layers of meaning that include both denotation and connotation. And denotation is its literal meaning. So astounded means shocked or greatly surprised. But what are the feelings, the ideas, the images that come with astounded and not necessarily shocked? Perhaps awe, wonder, amazement. Does it feel more positive, whereas shocked carries more of a negative feeling? So this is the connotative meaning of a word. And this gets into the slippery terrain of communication and interpretation, because a word may connote one thing for one reader that it may not for another. Wilbur has a commanding vocabulary, and I think it will become evident that he loves words for themselves. And this makes the dictions of his poems savory. Paradox. Paradox, we've been talking about all evening. It's a statement or a situation that seems but need not be self-contradictory. So in the last poem we read, "You sound dark's uttermost, strangely light brimming." This is a paradoxical situation that in the greatest depths of darkness, there is one who overflows with light. And in His Christ, God plunged in human waste and radiant. Radioactive might be more logically consistent, but radiant? That is the paradox. So you'll see more paradoxes in Wilbur's poem. So, two readings. I will read, and then Richard Wilbur will read for us his own poem. Love calls us to the things of this world. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bed sheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now of a sudden, they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rate of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice, as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance."
The mouse isn't working here. I was going to, there we are.
This is Richard Wilbur. He makes a couple comments at the end of his reading that you'll enjoy as well.
The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bed sheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now, of a sudden, they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's funks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance." One thing I like about that poem is that I managed to use the word punks in it. It's a word which is perhaps out of keeping with some of the rest of the language of the poem, but that's precisely why I'm glad that it's there and that I have apparently gotten away with it. And another poem that I wrote during that period in Rome, I was very pleased to be able to use the words reinforced concrete in a line of verse. You'd think that would sink a line of verse, absolutely, but I think it didn't quite in that case.
Honk. What other words do you like in this poem?
A wash.
A wash.
Laundry.
Laundry.
Wrapped.
Ruddy. Wrapped.
Smocks.
Smocks.
Bitter love.
Rosy. Halcyon. I had to look that one up. Halcyon means denoting a period of time in the past that was idyllically happy and peaceful. The nostalgia, the halcyon.
Do you want just words or a line?
You give me a line.
Let there be clean linens for the past.
White water.
Habit.
Dark habit. Heavy.
Clear dances.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so good. I'm gonna skip images that are crisp because I want to talk about what we're seeing at the start of this poem. What is he talking about? The eyes open to a cry of pulleys, inspirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Waking up. There it is. Yeah. I skipped him saying that, so it wouldn't give away the surprise, but he does say that at the beginning of his reading. But it's waking up and your neighbor is pulling their laundry across, and there it goes over your windowsill, or on the other side of your windowsill. So the morning air is all awash with angels. Wilbur is really good at clever puns. awash being one of them. And then continue to describe this image for me. Summer in bed sheets, summer in blouses, summer in smocks, but truly there they are. Now they're rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they're flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now, of a sudden, they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, this is too still. It's got to be a bit more like that. So, this is a windy day. It's a windy laundry day. Ben.
Yeah, to me, the variation of it all, it's just the air will fill up a sheet and it'll hang in the air for a second, and then the wind will gust, it'll flap in the air, and then the wind will stop, and it'll shifting air.
Yeah.
It's the impression of the laundry itself, of the invisible thing that's in it, kind of giving it shape.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is when you take a laundry, you don't take it all in at once, like this. You go, zip, 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 take off the shirt. Zip, 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 take off the other one. So it looks like, from the other end of the wash line, it looks like... I picture that in the poem.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of stopping and starting, at the actual rhythm of
When you first read it though, like I didn't actually get the image of like actual laundry.
Mm-hmm.
Like I sort of did, but I wasn't really thinking about it like that.
Yeah.
It's like when I heard it, it was that moment between waking and sleeping where your soul can see things where normally you can't.
Mm-hmm.
So like I was sort of getting like perceived the spiritual in the ordinary, and he's like, he was hovering before he was awake, and then he's like, I don't want to wake up, I want to keep seeing this. And then he's like, oh, I have to wake up and go back to the world, and like, so I was feeling like that struggle of like not wanting to wake up to reality, because you can see the beautiful spiritual world that's actually there. And most of the time you can't see it. But then when I was like, then reading it again with that picture, I was like, oh, that's just like what it looks like.
Uh-huh.
So it's like,
but I think you're getting at the significance of this, like the this almost out of body experience in that state between asleep and awake is happening in response to something very ordinary and common, but is suddenly seen and experienced as holy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what I was going to point out. It's a sort of transcendental type of energy that I got from it, where it's, like you said, out of body. When he talks about the soul hovering above just before it enters the body, it's a sort of separation between flesh and spirit. And that he's, at least from what I got from it, he's trying to paint that.
Let's follow this, because I think what happens in the relationship between the body and the spirit is really important in this poem. And it's not, I think it's difficult, actually. And I'm curious what others think here. So, from this point, the soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember. From the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam and clear dances done in the sight of heaven. This shrinking away from I gotta take on this body again. this seeming experience of out of bodiness, but then do I have to go back to the way that days are treated as something to just kind of plow through, exploit forcefully, violently sometimes? Is there holiness in the day anymore? But the yet in this poem is really important too, like in the last poem, the yet here. Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look, so I see here, the false dawn is that hour before the sun actually rises, when light is growing. I learned that false dawn is also a saying referring to a promising situation that may amount to nothing. And I think Wilbur is very cognizant of both of those meanings for this poem. So we're moving from false dawn into actual dawn. The sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors. So the laundry line is lighting up. Colors are warming. The soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises. What do you make of that? The soul descending once more in bitter love to accept the waking body.
My take on it is it's sort of going from the infinite to the specific and a sort of unconditional love upon that entrance and just pure acceptance of everything that it will encounter from that moment forward.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a different take a little. It feels much more reluctant. It feels like it's still, like the sun's acknowledging it, but you still have bitter love. You're accepting, you're not rejoicing in your way. Like you're still on the precipice of like, kind of yawning. Like, I don't know, it's not like, all right, jumps up, like surges into the day. And so I think there's still a tension.
Jen.
For some reason, during the first stanza and on the other page, reminded me of one another. And I know that we're sort of strung up on gallows ourselves. And when we wake to an understanding of reality, there we are, once again, strung up on our gallows. Our souls and our bodies, heaven and earth, goodness and wickedness, that.
I've been wrestling with this because in some ways it feels like there's a rejection of the bodily and a real a very stark divide between the spiritual and the physical. But I really think the changed voice and the blessing that comes from in that voice, like this, I read this last stanza as like this proclamation of blessing coming from the one who has had this out-of-body experience, taken body back on. Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Them being the sheets, the laundry, the angels, the angels that have been executed on the laundry line. I don't know. Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. But lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone. and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habit, keeping their difficult balance. Nuns may be epitomizing there people who are trying to live in the crux of the sacred and the secular, of heaven and earth here, living in this difficult balance. This trio, too, thieves, lovers, and nuns, clean white linen for thieves. Lovers in fresh, sweet-smelling clothes that will be promptly removed to enjoy their bodiliness together. And nuns, the contrast of the nuns in the dark, the black, and the thieves in white, I think is interesting here. What else do you make of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's something about the first part of the poem, which seems to be the spiritual, like the light, whatever. Mm-hmm. But what we're talking, what is imbibed in the spirit are the things of this world, laundry, veggie, the shirt, the smock, very tangible physical things, and the idea that we're also describing things that the function of those things is to cover that body.
Yeah.
You know, the function of a bed sheet, the function of a smock, the blouse, is to robe a body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this to me is something of the actually making something very physical, secular based, spiritual. To me, it's actually a really combining of those things and layering those things together. And the idea of, the level of the nuns, there's much more to it than this, but even like, you've kind of got the whole banner out there, don't you? It's for all of them. That spiritual is covered in all of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jeff?
Yeah, I'm struck by the allusion to Genesis, the creation of let there be, and let there go. And thinking about your other lecture about vocation towards creativity, the first act that the person does is to create something of this scenario. It's kind of like a poem within a poem.
Thank you. I hadn't even thought of the resonance of Genesis there.
Transition from one section to another.
Why
do you? There's something about clean laundry that being covered is looking for. No matter what, the way it is, going down the stairs. The cleanness of it. And one of the things about size is people smell it.
No. Less generous critics of Wilbur have said he is just idealizing laundry in the 1950s, 40s, 50s, hung on an urban line. Like, there is muck and dust and grime on that laundry. You wanted to respond to that.
Well, it just seems to me that the vision he's having in the false dawn is colorless vision, that everything seems white, or not light enough for the distinguish color.
Right.
The real dawn comes in hung in color. So it is, it may very well be all kinds of colors, and then maybe black doesn't have it, but in that pre dawn kind of mysterious moment, it's all the same.
Good point. Abigail.
There's a word that I can't get rid of that keeps jumping out, the word right. So in England, if you swear, I would say something bloody nuisance, you're actually referring to the blood of Christ. You can say bloody nuisance as a way of saying guard. That's something that, that religious people will not say bloody. And using it in that way is in that fashion. Therefore,
consistently referencing the blood test.
One critic I read pointed out the red and the white imagery throughout the poem. So, where are my notes on that? You can probably point them out yourselves here. But, you know, so white water, even steam being white, bed sheets, for me that is white. But then, you know, gray. That's the red word, rosy, tan, and yes, ready. And Andrew Fellows, who worked as the director of Labrie for a long time, worked at the English Labrie, he I think is borrowing from Chesterton here. You can tell me if that's the case. He talks about the incarnation being red and white together, not pink. Awful, awful pink, where it just becomes something else, you know. No, it is red and white next to each other, preserved in contrast.
I just wanted to Marty's comment just made me think of the theology of the atonement, which is that it's a two-way thing, that Christ has taken our sins, but then he has put his righteousness on us. In the sense of, our sins are just taken from us, but we're also covered with the righteousness of Christ. And so we have that is what we think. I just thought about that.
Mm-hmm. He was in World War II, and he actually, you know, said that poetry helped him kind of organize his world again after that experience. And again, some critics who are less favorable toward Wilbur say that he makes things too neat in the end. But in his own defense, he says that he does. Out of faith and an optimism or a hope for something that's ultimately undergirding his take on things and
so
what's in the
book.
Go ahead. I was hoping Lynn would still be here. Yeah.
I feel like there's a really clear distinction between the laundry up on the pulleys and on the gallows, and it's like laundry could serve the function of being there and looking beautiful, or it could, like Christ, could serve the function of just being the beauty. Mm-hmm. But instead, the laundry comes down and covers the ruddy people. Mm-hmm. And there's such a clear distinction between the laundry as it is, beautiful, and on us, which is also beautiful, but very different.
And that the poem kind of culminates there, seems to say, this is the better thing.
Right, because from the start, when I read it, it sounded completely like a gallows instead of a laundry line. That wasn't how I was hearing it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that was what he was trying to evoke in the first place, because it's all gallows imagery throughout the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, if you read it, some in bedsheets, some in blouses, some in smocks, it's like the crowd watching the gallows as well. There's such a emphasis on where cleanness could be.
I hope that we have all had our negative capability increased a little bit tonight, our our capacity for being in mystery strengthened. I hope that we have been dumbfounded, spirited from sleep, plunged into the mystery of the whole and irreducible point of Christ's descent, God plunged in human weight and radiant. I want to end by reading a very, very old statement of faith in what Christ did and who Christ was. And some have said this itself is a poem. So if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Amen. You are free to go. You are free to stay. If you want to talk more about these poems, I will stay for as long as you would like to raise other things. Yeah, Danny.
We didn't really talk about the title of the last one.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be Abby again.
Yeah, yeah. So what to make of the title, Love Calls Us to the Things of This World. That's what, I don't know if Wilbur himself has said explicitly, I'm referencing St. Augustine, but that's what many people see as an allusion is in the title here to Augustine, that love actually draws us more deeply into the world. It doesn't take us out of the world, but puts us into it, calls us back to it. So that's, I'm inclined to think, it probably is referencing Augustine in some way. But do you have thoughts on the title?
I don't know. I just kind of write stuff about
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think the word is just at the end, but I was just struck by the word hope. Like when I read that poem, that's what came across. But because like that beyond, it kind of for me like the vision of what's happening in that perfection or the living reality of what love has done for us in the meaningful, but it didn't have a higher hope. So in the sense of love all the two things will be part of the hope that God does transform, as well as what we will have. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is it on the title? Kind of
well, it was yeah. Interesting. Okay. I think of the film Wings of Desire, where it's in black and white. And it's the angels who long to look into the things that pertain to love and suffering and sacrifice and forgiveness. And you know, they are lovely and they're white and on that line, but their reason is impersonal. And they're with God and they have His joy and they have a peace and suffering.
Thank you for that. I was actually struck by Paul says what he does here as an encouragement to those who are suffering, and so I think you're right. There's something that sets us apart in a difficult but somehow a good way, even in our suffering, from the angel. I had a thought, and it was this, but in regards to the title, like I think the love calling us to the things of this world, it calls us out of ourselves too. So it's not enough to have an out-of-body experience, seeing angels in laundry and some sort of, surreal religious experience that takes us away from others and sort of entombs us in our individuality somehow. But a genuine encounter with God needs to change us. So He rises, He says in a changed voice, like, this is for others. This is for thieves. This is for lovers who don't even know the goodness of what they have in many ways. This is for nuns who are walking that weird line between holy and not holy. So I think it's that, too, that love takes us out of ourselves.
What you said there is suggesting that the presence of the angels here in the first place is for people. The presence of the angels here is God Himself, the given human being, the angels really are. There's something glorious about the human being.
Yeah.
And I mean, one thing that I don't know whether it's significant of the poem at all or not, but the voice of the sun, or the sun sort of reminding the pre-dawn when heaven, the sun wasn't coming, right? The sun's causing the whole thing. So the vision, pre-dawn, is the sun's almost there, and the sun's actually there, and then you see the point.
Thank you for that. Yeah. I think that is helpful. The sun is coming. Other thoughts or questions about any of this? Thank you all for your wholehearted engagement. We just look so hard at your presence.
Thank you.
Thank you.